morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
This is my last session. Yes, actually, it's been really, really. Oh, let me turn off my music. I enjoy it. I want to thank you for your presence here each morning. It wouldn't have been much fun if you weren't. Thank you for your generous and good attention, both in our conversations and to one another and to one another's stories. Thank you for the stories that we shared, both in the room, but also the stories we have shared outside of this room. It has been, I think this is my third time here at Holden, and I think one of the richest for me in terms of meeting people and hearing stories. Some of them I'm still not sure I believe. Where's Chuck? No, the other Chuck. Where's Chuck Anderson? Is he here?
Yeah.
There he is, the back. I still don't know whether I believe half the stories you've told me. But I recommend grabbing half an hour with this man. And, even if they're not true stories, they're brilliant. So thank you for sharing stories. And I am so passionate about the need to tell stories and to need to learn how to listen well to stories. I'm convinced that the better we become at that and the more open we become with our stories, actually the better we become at reading and understanding our sacred text. And the better we can understand our sacred text, the better we can understand our own stories and our own life journeys, and these things are woven together. So I'm grateful, enormously grateful for the way you pitched in. And for those of you, your generosity as we've messed with some of the stories that we've received as children, and we're gonna do that again today, perhaps, with what is possibly even in popular culture, the best known of the Bible stories, the best known of the parables of Jesus. I'll say something about that in a moment. Again, the story of the prodigal son is a story about family. I think part of its popularity is to do with the fact that, I mean, who doesn't want to know that there is always a welcoming presence at home waiting for us, should we choose to return? And certainly when we hear that story as children, that can be deeply, deeply reassuring and comforting to know that is true. But what happens as we grow with that story and life just gets more complicated? What if there isn't a welcoming presence at home? What if there isn't a home to return to? What if relationships are fractured and broken? What do we do with this story? How do we live with this story? And partly that's what we want to revisit today. As I've done throughout this, part of it has been revealing some of the stories of my family, and I know myself. You know, John asked us to consider the question of when we recognized our privilege, and I know that I am. That an enormous part of the power I have to make decisions in my life is because of a secure and family life, and I don't take that for granted. This is a photograph of my great grandmother. Even in my living memory, this is my father's mother. They had no running water in their home. And you know, and the child that my great grandmother and my great aunt, well, we say adopted, but John Joe wasn't really adopted. He just found his way into their house, into their home as a child, and has lived there his whole life. John Joe's now in his late 60s, early 70s, and finally, you know, that the house they've lived in their whole lives is finally beginning to be turned into a more recognizable home. But this was a place we visited, and it was you gathered water from the well and brought it into our house, as I said, even in my memory. This is a photograph of my mum and dad get on their wedding day. These are my mum's sisters on this side. This is my dad's brother and his youngest sister and brother, who are twins, and this is one of his best friends on their wedding day. I'm just enjoying showing you photographs. It gives you a sense of where. And this is a photograph of my grandfather, my dad's dad, and mum, and that's me. At the same house that I showed you, the same home of my great grandmother in a small town called Rathdrum. And that's me. This is me on the coldest beach in the whole of the world. And every summer, my mom insisted that we had to go on a picnic to the beach in my hometown of Bray, which is just south of Dublin. And there's a promenade, there's the sea, the beach, a promenade, then there was a slight drop, a bit higher than this, and then grass, and everybody would spread their picnic blankets along the grass at the drop from the promenade, mainly to shelter from the freezing cold wind coming off the sea. So you'd hunker down here, and then you'd pop up and get back down. But as a wee one, you didn't feel it, obviously. This is me on my 21st birthday with both my grandmothers. This is my mother's mother, who grew up. Our family is such a mix of things, but this is my Nana Jordan and this is my Nana Riley. She grew up in Northern Ireland in a Protestant home where her father was the leader of one of the kind of the Orange Order, which is one of the kind of cultural organizations back home. The classic fairy tale story of a mother, her mum dying early, her father marrying again, and the stepmother and the oldest daughter not having a relationship. She ran away from home at 14. That's when her education stopped. Ran away from home to Belfast and was homeless in Belfast probably in the late 40s, early 50s. Was taken in by a Catholic monastery in Belfast, where she worked in that monastery for a number of years, converted to Catholicism, and then moved south and married what would have been my grandfather, had five children, and then he left her, just walked out one day, never came back. Apparently went to England, joined the British Army, and then my mom, in her late 50s, early 60s, found out he married again over there, whole new family, and that they knew nothing about. She had, but then when I moved north of the border to work in Belfast, my Nana Riley was so proud because she felt and then about 7 or 8 years ago, I got to preach in the Catholic monastery that had taken her in, and was able to tell her story in this place. She was an amazing woman, tiny little woman. This is me on my wedding day. I look so young. And this is my mom and dad today, and my two, Christopher and Philippa, CJ and Phil. And it's the circle of these things. All these people have fed into life, and I know the privilege that I've always had a welcome back home. And that is something I don't take for granted. And so I can understand this story from a particular way. Just to complete the circle, John Notner and I have had a running competition about dog photos all week. So he's not here, so I'm going to show two photographs of dogs this morning. That's our test. And this is our Bodhi. Or this photograph, we call him Boda. Boda. Yeah, they're also an extraordinarily important part of the family. Let's get straight into the text, because I want to walk through the text of this story quickly and then give you some work to do. It comes from Luke chapter 15. It's actually three stories of lost things wrapped up together. Now, the tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering round to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the wide open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I've found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So these are the first two stories of lost things. If we were to write a summary of, if we were to write both of those stories and find chapter headings for them, we would probably, one possible way of understanding these stories is through four chapter headings. So the first thing is, something is lost. So there's a lost sheep, there's a lost coin, and something is lost. What's the next thing that's common to both stories? There's a frantic search. Frantic search for the coin and a frantic search for the sheep. Chapter 3, how would you expand chapter 3?
Found.
Yeah, easy. Something is found. And chapter 4 is?
Rejoice.
Yeah, there's a party. There's a celebration. So four chapters, something lost, a frantic search is organized, something is found, and then there's a celebration, a party. It's common in both of them. These final sentences are unusual in that they, I think a lot of the kind of gospel experts now would say, these things don't follow cleanly after the story, and many would say that they think these are kind of, this is Luke trying to offer a bit of context, because these three stories that we're going to look at don't really fit together with this. And so there's a possibility, just a possibility, that this is a Lucan addition to the stories. Trying to kind of fit them into a particular form. But each of these stories has somebody in a position of responsibility who then loses something that they have responsibility for. Organize a frantic search, eventually find it, and then they celebrate. Okay? Now here's where we've got to do some work. Carry those four chapter headings into this third story of lost things. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. after he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went back to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on, and put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him, 'What's going on?' 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you're always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" Such a familiar story. If you've been brought up through church and church life and familiar with your Bible and with preachers and preaching, then doubtless you've heard this story many times. The fourfold chapter headings break down, though, in this story. And that's what I'd like to explore. As I talked about it in the early, that's one of the doors I think that we can open into another room of this story. How does it break down? How does the chapter headings from the previous, how does this story differ from the two lost stories before?
There's no frantic search. It doesn't seem to be.
I find this extraordinary. There is no frantic search. Now, we notice this, of course. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him. So it's not like the father is inattentive, but this isn't enough for a lost son. Particularly, we know information is getting back from the far country, because the older brother knows what he's doing in the far country with the inheritance. So we know there's an information flow. So presumably with that information flow comes something to do with the famine in the land. But if you know your child is in dire straits and you have any sort of a decent relationship with that child, that is not enough when that child is in trouble. I've showed you several times photographs of my children. We are very close. If I thought one of my children, if the news came to me today, now that one of my children was in trouble, I'd be on the next boat out of here. Immediately. And someone else could finish the session. I honestly think this is inadequate. Yes?
We don't know if the father early on did search, and if the father tried to reach the prodigal son, and the prodigal son would not respond. So that's a piece for me that he overlooked sometimes.
Yep.
In the story.
Okay.
Because as a parent, I too would go to the ends of the earth.
Yep.
But if that son said, "Get away."
Yeah. And we need to consider that as we go through.
I felt strongly about that. I was angry.
Yeah.
I was. I was like.
Yeah, yeah.
And I haven't had to search for Eric yet, but.
He's a big guy. It'd be hard to miss. But I think. But we need to piece together some other evidence in the story, to see just what degree of. To give us hints towards it, it's entirely possible. But there are other hints in the story in a close reading that might open up something of the attitude of the father.
I don't think that son might not consider himself lost. He took that money and he left.
It's,
now, how we look at the son, it's kind of like the older son. He's out spending his money on prostitution. In all honesty, we don't know that. We're looking at that story through that older boy's eyes.
There is a big question here about who is lost.
Yeah, who's lost?
And there is a big question about who's lost and the identity of who is lost. Or what is lost, maybe that's a better.
I think we also need to look at the possibility that if we take it into modern context, the son, the prodigal son, may have done things to drive a wedge between him. Addiction is rife in our current society. People who have cut their children off because of what their children were doing to feed their addictions.
This is, you know, there is something that has driven a wedge between father and son, and it is the question, give me my share of the estate.
Oh, yeah.
The proper response to that question in that culture is that the younger son should be dragged down to the village square and given a beating by his father. Because what he has done, and I'm sure many of you have heard it, it's tantamount to asking, to expressing a wish that his father was no longer on the scene. I can't wait any longer, give me that. But that question, that request, represents a threat to the established order of that whole village. So the father is humiliated, but also there is a wedge driven between the father and the rest of the village, because he has allowed this to happen.
He has given him
the money, and he should not have done this. That was an utterly improper request. There is a proper response to it, but the father, one way of reading this story is in the relationship here, this is a father who has utterly indulged this son to the extent that both of them have been spoiled by it. Father and son have been damaged by the way he has indulged this son.
Well,
but
still, you know, that older son, you talk about where's the wedge. How do we know that father didn't want to go look for that boy? And the older son, there he is again. He's driving a wedge. You can't go out there,
Dad.
We
will consider other evidence as we go through the story. I am intrigued. I am intrigued by the person of the father. Again, if you think about the two stories, a person in responsibility loses something that they are responsible for. Somehow, either Jesus told these three stories together or Luke organized these three stories together. Either way, we've got stories about people in responsibility who lose things they shouldn't have lost. And we've got to examine what has caused this lostness. And what do you notice about the speech that's prepared by the son when he comes to his senses versus the speech he delivered? The speech he prepared is in verse 17.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't offer to be a servant.
He doesn't?
Doesn't offer to be a servant.
Not interesting. Before he has a chance to complete the prepared speech, which includes a humbling of the son, take me on as one of your servants, the father interrupts the speech. And so he knows the younger boy who I'm going to offer to you for consideration for this morning This is a boy who has been indulged his whole life and is coming to his senses here. He is learning something through the trial he is experiencing. He recognizes here, but when he gets back, he realizes this owl fool has learned nothing. And he falls right back into the same attitudes and habits that he had before he left. And he knows, I don't have to do anything to earn my way back into this family again. This fool has forgiven me already. And he indulges and bring out the coat and all the rest of it, and the ring on his finger, and the fatted calf. And the thing about a fattened calf is that's not a meal for the nuclear family. Father, mother, and 2.4 children. This is a meal for the village. There's another set of parables. There's another parable Jesus tells about the man who sends out an invitation to the village to come to a party. And they write back and they say, they're coming. And in again, the background to that is when you send out two invitations. The first invitation is to find out how many people want to come, because that will determine the size of the beast you will slaughter. So if the whole village is coming, you need the calf. If only half the village is coming, it might be a lamb. If only your neighbor is coming, it might be a chicken. So you get the invitations back. Everybody's coming. He kills the calf. And then he sends out the second invitation. The meal's ready. Everybody come. And then they think, oh, do you know, I've just bought a team of horses and I'm going in to have a look at them. Seriously? You bought a team of horses? You've never checked them out before now? Or I just bought a field, I'm going to look at it now. You mean you bought land and you never saw it? And then there's the third excuse is, oh, I've just got married. And there's no excuse given. So you're meant to, sorry, it's a piece of comedy, you're meant to read into why you're too busy to come to my party. I've just got married. But he's got a fattened calf. And so he sends out to the byways, he sends an invitation out to the highways and byways and brings everybody else in. So he's killing a fattened calf. Firstly, this takes time. And secondly, it's the whole village. So there is a celebration. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again, he was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. This is where the story gets even more complicated. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. And here's a little bit more evidence about the father. Do you pick it up?
He forgot about the son.
He forgot about his son. He called the village to a party and forgot his son, like his family. Like, he forgot it. The son had to find out by asking a servant. This son, we tend to be critical of this son, oh, he's a bit dour. This is the perfect son. This is the son you want, who works hard, is loyal, is committed, and so on. And he's coming home from working in your field long after this party has got started. Long day in the field. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. Carry with you, as we go on through the story now, the relational language here. Your brother, your father. The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and you've given me nothing. Yet this son of yours, there's no word of relationship here. This son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home and you kill a fattened calf for him. He has ruined the reputation of his family, and yet when he comes back, you go to all these lengths to celebrate them. I have enormous sympathy for this boy. because he has grown up, he's the older boy, he has grown up watching his younger brother being indulged. And it all explodes at this point because he realizes, even though the father has been humiliated, perhaps repeatedly by the younger boy, the father has learned nothing. And the boy is angry. A couple of seconds, just let's get to the end, because I want to give you a task to think about and reflect on. The father insists on relational language. My son, I think this is the point at which the father comes to his senses and learns something. You are always with me, and everything I have is yours. That's true, because he has already divided the inheritance and the younger boy has his share. So everything remaining belongs to the older boy. Remember we talked about one of the previous stories that for Jews the blessing of the land is visceral. The land is your connection to God. The shame brought upon this family is that when he had to sell some of this land to get the money that the boy, the younger boy, could carry away, and now he's lost everything. So this father has had to cut off part of this family's inheritance, part of this family's real connection with God. But everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours, again, insisting on relational language, this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And? What happened? Where? This is the brilliance of Jesus as a storyteller and the frustration with him, because so many of the parables are unfinished. We don't know what happens. And this is, I talk about the door in the story that we open and we step through if we're brave enough. This is like these great big double doors that you open wide, and it's an enormous palatial entrance. What happened, Jesus? Tell me, what happened? What did he do? Because that's a wholly inadequate ending. And one of the keys to working with the parables, Jesus always leaves a loose thread in a parable, and he dares you to pull it. Often it's shouting at us like this unfinished part of the story, and he invites us to complete the story. I imagine this happening on the porch of their house. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm a holder. I imagine it happening on a porch, and where if I was filming this scene. Outside of the porch, it's dark. Inside the house, there's music and there's light and there's laughter. And it's this in-between space, half in the light, half dark. This conversation's happening. The question is, what's next? What options are open in this broken family, in these broken relationships? I've got a task for you to do, and again, like always, you can choose to reflect on this by yourself. Your neighbor will not mind. If you are social and you want to talk about this, then do so with your neighbor, or with them twos or threes. And the task I've got for you is to think about these options, but not right now, not here at this point. I want you to think about what they do now in the light of what's about to happen. 10 years from now, from that conversation, the father dies. The morning after the father dies, the older son inherits all the land. What happens that morning depends on what happens on the porch. What happens 10 years from now when the older boy inherits the whole land, all the land, depends on what happens when that conversation picks up after the father's statement. What's possible? What options are possible? And to get to the best possible option, what is it going to cost and who is it going to cost? Okay? So take 5 or 10 minutes and then we come back and have a conversation. This is one way into this. We're imagining the ending of this story because this is how we write ourselves into it.
I'm together. What an amazing thing to hear that level of conversation about one of the most familiar texts in the Bible. Let me say a couple of things first by way of, as we enter into this next conversation. From the beginning, I said that we are not talking about these stories in the context of this is the right answer to the story. So if perhaps someone in the room is struggling with, from childhood we've received this story where the father is the hero, and you're struggling with a view in this story where the father is the villain. This is not to undo that version of the story and tell you that was wrong. This is to say, now that we're older and we know how complicated human relationships are, there are other ways of reading this story as well. You see, it's dead easy to reunite a sheep with the flock. It's even easier to reunite a coin with a purse. If you can find it. But rebuilding broken human relationships is really, really hard. And the brokenness of those relationships have long-lasting generational impacts. Mm-hmm. To reconcile those relationships, at least somebody shares a sizable proportion of the pain of that restoration. And the willingness to shoulder and the amount of pain willing to shoulder is a measure of how much we're committed to the relationship or not. And we are willing that others bear the pain of brokenness while we, because things are okay for us. And things can be okay for one party in this story. What options are open this moment on the porch? And as you take one of those options, what are the implications for 10 years hence? What options are open on the porch?
Reconcile.
Okay, so what does that look like? What is required at that point for a reconciliation?
The older brother joins the party.
He goes into the party. And describe his attitude going into the party. Because he could go into the party and shun his brother. Like, that's not a reconciliation. So he goes in. He is effectively the landowner.
Yeah.
And a person of status in the village. He could go up and embrace his brother. And there's a reconciliation. So 10 years, so let's say that happens. That might be the Hollywood ending. 10 years from now, when the father dies, what follow through on that reconciliation to 10 years down the line?
It could be that the father, that he treats his brother as a servant. You've spent your inheritance. Father asked me to keep you alive, but you'll stay alive with the servants and you'll eat with them and you'll sleep with them, and that's as good as it gets. Or the brother could be that gracious, forgiving son who, as the patriarch now, says, well, there's a piece of land, it's part of mine, and build your future.
Oh.
And they lived happily ever after.
You know,
that's extraordinary.
This, yes, it absolutely is extraordinary. But look, unless reconciliation happens, the worst possible outcome of this is that 10 years from now, when the father dies and the older brother becomes the patriarch, that the younger brother is as destitute as he was when he was a young man. And this is a forever broken. This is a forever conflict. But there is the possibility as we craft the different endings for this story. There is the opposite extreme of that, which is the reconciliation over time is so complete that the patriarch in 10 years' time divides the land again. The person with the power chooses a reconciliation and a restoration so complete, carries the cost of that reconciliation to make it so complete, that the land is shared again and everybody has security. Everybody has a future.
Couldn't that possibly depend on the younger son's behavior in the 10 years, though?
Right. First.
Yeah. And the risk for the older boy with the power and the wealth is that there is a generosity so complete that it leads to his healing as well. And we think, I don't know, that's too big. That's too big a risk. But how much do I value peace? How much do I value justice? How much do I value restoration of relationships? What cost am I willing to bear for that to happen? This is why I say this is such a complicated story, because Jesus deliberately didn't answer it, because he says, he's effectively saying to us, take a measure of the cost. Because the older boy doesn't really lose out if the animosity continues. The cost to him is a relationship with his younger brother. Can you live with that? Can you live with the animosity? Can you live with... And Jesus is saying there is a cost to reconciliation. And this isn't a sweet thing. There is a cost, and in this case the cost is falling on the shoulders of the boy with the money and the power and the position and the privilege and the wealth. And the challenge is, how much does he value relationship? Or is he prepared to put up with the conflict? Come back to these two.
There is also a cost of not reconciling, because the older brother is still going to be living with his father. If the older brother shuns his younger brother, he still has to deal with the disapproval of his father. So even if he does shun, there's still going to be a cost to be paid.
There's always a cost for division. Always. Always. And sometimes we can shelter ourselves to a degree from the cost if we are, if we have the resource and the privilege. But there is always a cost, even if that cost is, the need to live in the constant fear of losing your place. That's a cost. But there is similarly a cost in reconciliation. Yes, John.
I've been thinking about the older brother and the younger brother taking a long walk. And the older brother brings his rage, and the younger brother brings his whatever, a little bit of guilt, something. And that in that walk, they both realize that the father has actually created this whole scene. That it was the father's spoiling of the young, that somehow the dad is not innocent in this whole story.
No.
And they form a bond together to find out how to be sons of a father who doesn't know how to be a good dad. Now, this is kind of way out there, but this is, I was looking for some option down the road.
Yeah. And we all know in our own human relationships with family and friends and neighbors, community, we know it politically and at a national level, We know it on a continental level back in Europe. There is a cost to the breakdown of relationships, and there is a risk in the reestablishing of relationships. There's a cost to pay. Yes,
and that's a good story.
So this great rides on the coattails of what my dad just said. when we were talking about it, and I've never looked at it from this particular angle, which is just really cool. And all of a sudden, it reminded me of a personal story. So my brother, who is not here, not David, is saying.
Okay. Can everybody hear?
No. So my older brother, who is not here right now. Oh, okay. My older brother, who's not here right now, he was the one who, let's just say when I was a teenager, I was not a picnic. Sorry, Mom. It was actually, so my older brother is one of the people who I've always loved and respected the most. And, all my brothers, I have. but this brother, he's 3 years older, we grew up together, and one day, I don't even remember exactly the context, but I was indulged a lot as a kid, and my parents are amazing, they're sitting next to me, so no judgment on you guys, but I was indulged a lot, and one day, my older brother, he called me out, and he... Like, Dad, you just talked about rage. He let me have it.
Yeah.
And he said, I hate the person you're becoming. But that moment, that was transformational for me. And I wouldn't be who I am today without that rage, without that animosity, and without that willingness to confront me. And that just really struck me here as, yeah, maybe it's that willingness to just honestly call the younger brother out, and I'd never looked at that brother and possibly that exchange as the reason for the reconciliation, the rage and the animosity, but and being able to share that as potentially the catalyst to that.
I also had one thing that I'm always struck in this story by the younger brother when he's off in the far land, and how he's, you know, sometimes you have to leave the context where you've become a problem, you have this mindset, you think you know everything, and this is true for everyone. You go out in the world, you get different experiences, meet different people, you're educated, if anybody has read that book, you know, and you become just a different person because of your new place. And when he comes up with that speech, just make me a servant, you know, at least I'll get food. He's not, you know, coming up with the speech, well, my dad will, you know, let me do whatever I want anyway when I get back. You can see he's got it. It has sunk in, and he's going to beg to be a servant. And so when his older brother goes in, no matter how angry he is, I feel like the cards are mainly in the younger brother's hands. How is he going to react to the older brother? If he's really gotten it, like I think he has, he may come up and be as remorseful to the older brother as to his dad. You know, he has a long walk home to think about everything, including his older brother. So, anyway, I feel like he does.
This is great. This is what stories do. And they invite us into the ending, and they invite us into this room. As we open these doors, they invite us into the room, and they invite us to consider simply, what would I do in that context? What can I hear? What am I willing to hear for the sake of reconciliation? What am I willing to say? And I've been here 2 weeks now, and I've sat in on sessions in which there have been difficult things to hear about, you know, even the question John Notner challenged us with, when did I become aware of my privilege? Even in my session 2 days ago, Joe and Dave challenged me from the balcony about questions I asked, and I had to walk away from that session and think about even the way I framed the questions demonstrated that there was a certain degree of privilege that I had to be able to frame the question that way, and I needed to hear from people who had the courage to call me out on something. to say, yes, I need to change that question now. What are we willing to hear for the sake of growth, for the sake of change in the broken relationships that are all around us and the brokenness that's all around us? What can I hear, and what am I willing to contribute to making this thing right again? We don't have time to do this, but I did have another task, because I think this is a worthwhile conversation. But even as we wrap up, there's another way, another door that can open into this story that maybe you can take with you down the lake as you're going. I would be really interested to know, what does this story look like from the perspective of a mother? What's her attitude towards her husband? How does she... I can only speak from my own family, and the family of which I'm a sibling has a completely other story, that's maybe for another time, which is complex. But certainly in our house, my son CJ and his mom are like that. And they always say that me and Phil are like that. Who does the mother in this story connect with? And how does that change the perspective? Is she indulgent of the younger son like the father? Is she closer to the dutiful, good, loyal son? What would she have to say to her husband? What would she have to say to her returning son? What option would she encourage the son she has influence over to take? How might she frame that? How would we rewrite this story if it was told from the mother's perspective? Again, there's no right answer. That's not what a story's for. A story is there to invite us into this other room, as I said, that opens with new spaciousness for us, if we have the courage to step over the threshold that it invites us to. And I'm going to leave you with that one. And I hope leave you too with a renewed curiosity to go back to some of the stories that perhaps you felt you'd left behind as a child, to return to them with adult eyes. Leave you too with, I hope, renewed confidence, or confidence in the capacity of our sacred text to speak even into the complexity of the world in which we are, we're all trying to make sense of. And I leave you with an enormous sense of gratitude for the way we have engaged together in these old stories. I would have completely understood if you'd seen the list up on the deck and thought, oh, not the prodigal son again. But maybe there's something new in there that will help it to speak into your personal context, or your community, your church, and certainly into the nation. Thanks for going on this exploration. Thanks for your stories. Thanks for the new stories we've written and the new perspectives we've brought on old stories. It's been great, and I've enormously appreciated it.